Hello and welcome to the Mega Game Assembly Podcast. Thank you very much for downloading this month's episode, which, as ever, is an absolute corker. This month, Matty has once again been joined by LJ, who regular listeners will remember from her episode discussing Den of Wolves last year, and Ed Silverstone making his podcast debut. Together, they talk about Red Planet Rising, an online game designed by Andrew Shield Dodds. They also, of course, go off on a few tangents about running games and have some excellent tips for being control at a game. So without further waffle from me, sit back and enjoy.
Okay, so we are here to talk about Red Planet Rising, which happened on 12th of December, I think.
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah, 12th of December. Okay, good note. Yeah, so we have here Ed Silverstone and LJ Saxton, and we're going to have a bit of a different format for a Mega Game Report. So we're going to do a sort of Mega Game Report, but from the perspective of control. So LJ and Ed were both control at the day. LJ, you've been on the podcast before. Welcome back.
Thanks. Nice to be back.
For those that don't know you, Ed, could you give us a little bit of an introduction?
Sure. So, yeah, I'm Ed. I've been involved in Mega Gaming for a few years now. My first Mega Game was Watch the Skies because, you know, I like to be different. I game controlled a game of Arrival here in Reading, UK, where I live 2-3 years back now. And then wrote and ran my own Mega Game last year, which was, I say last year, I see that it's January, so year before last now, which was based on the English Civil War. And since Mega Games have moved online, I've got very plugged into that. I've helped control a number of them and even got to play a couple. So that's me in Mega Gaming. In real life, I do some analysis for the National Grid, move electricity around the country, which is far less interesting.
Brilliant.
It's just a different kind of interesting.
I mean, I enjoy it, but I don't think our listeners or Matty's listeners will be particularly interested in hearing about it.
I'm sure there's a niche podcast somewhere that does talk about electricity moving around.
Oh, I'm sure there is.
But anyway, that's not what we're here to talk about. We're here to talk about Mega Games. LJ, could you give us a little bit of an overview of the game and the setting?
Yeah, so I like to think of Red Planet Rising as, for those familiar with board games, it's kind of like Terraforming Mars, the Mega Game. So it's built around the exploration and colonization of Mars. Years ago, nuclear war broke out on Earth, kind of between Earth and Mars, and everyone on Mars was stranded by ourselves. We were in kind of like individual teams / colonies built upon like the Biodyne Corporation that had representatives from years ago, a university research complex, just different groups based on kind of the origins of people that were sent up to Mars. But we've been completely cut off from Earth and have to figure out how to survive and whether or not we want to destroy each other and form a government and everything like that.
Yeah, so the game divides players into one of three roles. Each team has a leader who's sort of doing the diplomacy for their faction, setting policy and intent, and trying to work out if they want to build a government, if so, what government should be built, etc. They've got a sort of trader / economic manager who is making sure that the citizens of their colony have enough resources, trading with other factions and working out which of their various dilapidated, falling apart resource production buildings should be manned by which of their population. And finally, you've got the military player who's moving various ersatz military units around a map and occasionally bumping into other military players.
Excellent. Could you both give us a brief, you know, essentially your control role on the day?
Sure. So I was plot control, and which basically means that with the help of Ed and Dan, I made sure that the game had a narrative flow to it, and that if people wanted to do things that weren't kind of implicitly obvious how to do them, they could figure out how to drill underneath the surface and build tunnels or blow something up.
Yeah, and I was doing politics control, which meant sort of my time was sort of divided between administering the mechanics for politics, but then also thinking about the sort of narrative impact of political decisions people were making and trying to make sure that those folded back into the game with various mechanical effects as well.
Yeah, it was something that Tim for the Watch the Skies game game we ran online described in a really nice way, where he described it as the if the players punch the map, having the map punch back, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
That's a good way to describe it.
Yeah, just keeping the world feeling alive. Inevitably in mega game design, you build game mechanics for the things that you think players are going to do regularly, but the whole point is that it's a living, breathing world and it should act and react to anything that players do that they should conceivably be able to do in a living, breathing world.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And what kind of prep were you both involved in as control ahead of the day? You know, what were you doing as to prepare?
So I think kind of the first thing that I remember jumping in to help with was helping revise some of the team briefings. So they didn't change a ton, but there were definitely a couple of significant changes from the first run, and just kind of going through them, helping make sure that they made sense, especially since I had been a part of the first one as a player and interacted with most of the factions over the span of the game, you know, just trying to make sure that everybody was set up to have a good time and had achievable goals with what I thought would be likely to happen. And then Dan and Andrew and Ed and I, for context, Dan was the person that was kind of running the game and doing main game control. And Andrew was the person that designed the game initially and ran it in the first run. And then Ed was plot control. This Ed was plot control the first time that I played it. And since this was my first time as plot control, he was definitely a hugely invaluable resource to making sure that I didn't mess things up too bad. But we did some planning about what we thought the likely, you know, major narrative arcs could be and how to make those work and just what made sense for them.
Yeah. One big advantage of online mega games versus sort of in-person mega games is that the way they tend to have been done with a Discord server in place and so forth, you get to see the players' pre-game discussions and their early planning. And so although 90% of the plans players make have sort of died a death in the first couple of turns, you still have enough time to sort of monitor what they're discussing, think about, oh, if they did that, what would be an appropriate cost for it, what would be an appropriate mechanical reward for it, and start to sort of put stuff in place so that you avoid the scenario where on the day you're having a sort of panicked knee-jerk reaction to something and hopefully still coming up with something balanced, but maybe not as perfectly balanced as if you've had time to consider.
Yeah.
It was also super helpful to have Andrew around, and I will say a massive shout out to Andrew, who's designed a really quality game here and has taken the feedback from the first game really thoughtfully and worked well to sort of tighten the game up as an experience, which is great to see. And like having him around to just sort of feedback in, okay, what teams felt left out, were they left out in sort of inevitable ways, and how can we correct that in the second run, and all that sort of thinking. That's just, I mean, having the game designer around is always super valuable to sort of just understand the intent and the sort of vague narrative structure of the universe.
Yeah.
And the backstory.
100%.
Yeah. So was Andrew not involved as much in the running of this one?
He was. He took the role of economic control.
Okay.
Part of the reason for that was that the game, as it stands, runs off a series of spreadsheets, which are of his design. And I think last time the game ran, he ended up being drawn in quite a lot to sort of debugging those spreadsheets or sort of showing other control people how to use them or how he'd intended for them to be used. So by being economic control, he was sort of able to be hands-on with the most technically complicated part of the control role, which he seems to enjoy, which is great, because I certainly don't. He also did it very efficiently, which was great.
Cool. So at the beginning of the game, what were the sort of initial things that started moving and which you ended up focusing on as control?
I think for me, it was the beginning of the game was actually kind of the only time that I had time to think and breathe for the most part. So in general, I think that people take the first turn or two to figure out how the game works and figure out who they get along with, like in the game, and start to really explore the map. And then once the map has been explored, that's when people tend to get more into plot stuff. So the beginning of the game was, for me at least, was almost exclusively following up with people that had had plans that they had discussed before the game. So we on the control side had discussed what we thought made sense for costs and benefits of some of the plans that people had proposed, but we didn't actually communicate that until the game start. So I spent probably the first 15 minutes just like copying and pasting from a Word document where I'd put all of the all of the descriptions and explanations for the teams that had kind of done some level of pre-planning. And then the first couple of turns, for the most part, was just following up with those. And then the game had a couple of traders making sure that they knew what their goals were and if they had questions about how to achieve them, just things like that. So the beginning was a little bit slow for me.
Yeah. So for me, the game also started a little slowly. Sort of people, as LJ says, take time to work out who they want to work with. And often they're, much like in real life, their decisions about who they want to work with are only partly determined by, you know, the backstory and politics of their team. And they're also just determined by who they end up having chemistry with, if the team that they're most closely politically aligned with just they find awkward to work with personally, they may well end up making a less rational alliance. And it's not like that's unknown in the sort of history of the world and real world politics either. So people kind of maneuvered around each other quite slowly, and I was fielding a few questions just to clarify exactly how the politics rules worked. But otherwise, yeah, the first turn or two, playing it pretty slow, trying to sort of give people very slow, careful nudges to say, listen, the rules are set up so that if you manage to form a government, if you manage to be part of a government that forms one or the other, then you're in a better position, but not trying to sort of bully people into jumping the gun, making rash decisions.
I think narratively as well, early on, the kind of central cluster of factions that are in the middle of the map, kind of in the main city, decided, despite having a lot of briefing information about how they should distrust each other, they decided to kind of come together and form like a major main peaceful coalition working together. And obviously, you know, when there's less kind of conflict and people wanting to branch out from each other, they end up playing the game a little bit more together and a little bit less with control, at least in the beginning. So they formed a main central government based in the main city of Mars, where they were kind of like all peacefully working together.
My experience of being control is that you very often have a sort of settling in phase for the players, where, you know, the sort of your role is more helping players out with just the base understanding of the game and what they can do, and plots sort of starting to form. And then the second half of the game ends up being a lot more narrative focused and on managing the sort of evolving plot. So I think it's, you can definitely get kind of a role of two halves almost as a control player. And it sounded like this game had kind of similar.
Yeah, for sure.
Oh, for sure. Like, I know that the resource and map controls were a little bit overwhelmed at the beginning because, you know, they were on the other end of the spectrum where everybody has all these mechanical questions as they're trying to figure out the interface and the game, the way that the game works mechanically. And so they had much heavier beginnings, and not that things really got light for them later in the game, but it definitely eased off towards the end.
Yeah, I'd say another key distinction between your sort of online and offline gaming is that if players have questions about how the game world works, they can ask those in the days leading up to the game, and most will. So you'll often have like chats going on in the Discord server saying, oh, you know, I just want to understand my faction and how they think about X, Y, Z and how we got to this particular place. And that's great. But obviously, like, in an in-person game as a sort of plot control, game control role, your first few turns are taken up having those kind of conversations, whereas in an online game they've already been had, so you've got a bit of a burden taken away from you.
Yeah. And do I understand correctly by it, it sounded a bit like this sort of peaceful block that developed at the beginning of the game didn't necessarily last for the entire time?
Oh, of course.
They did surprisingly well, actually. So your instincts are correct that it didn't persist, and to an extent as control, we definitely intervened there because a number of factions just wanted to be part of the big club naturally. So once the faction started to pull itself together, it naturally attracted more people, and there's an extent to which that's not inherently bad for a mega game. It just changes the nature of the conflict, so that I certainly started to approach different factions and say, well, listen, your faction beliefs about how the planet should be run are X, Y, and Z. The government that you've joined doesn't represent any of those. So that doesn't mean you have to leave, but it does mean that unless you're seen to be putting strong pressure on the government to move more in that direction, your citizens are going to feel quite unhappy. And so sort of having that conversation with a few people and bit by bit, I sort of had those conversations, didn't necessarily immediately see much come of them, went away, kind of got involved in other things, and then sort of discovered a little later that actually people had been taking them quite seriously, and the central government team, the team that were currently at the head of the government, had begun to become quite worried that they were trying to hold together a faction with inherently opposing worldviews, which is a perfectly fine conflict to have in a mega game, that you've got this massive faction made up of people with radically conflicting ideologies. How on earth do you keep them moving in the same direction? What carrots and sticks can you use? We even had a couple of two teams within that faction actively fighting each other at one point. And again, sort of the game has a lot of neat levers. So one of the things I really like about Red Planet Rising is it has a lot of sort of trackers that represent these sort of things. So every faction has a stability, every government has a legitimacy score. And so as soon as two organizations within the same government start actively fighting each other, well, naturally that government's legitimacy score gradually begins to sink, and as control you can just move that lever, and it's a perfectly reasonable explanation, a perfectly reasonable way of reflecting that, okay, if you're saying you're in charge but you can't stop people fighting each other, then you maybe don't look as powerful as you'd like to, people maybe don't respect you as much, and so on and so forth.
It also helped that there were a number of traitors in the game. I think there were four total, two of which were in factions in kind of the central government from the beginning, and they obviously don't want as is the way that traitors tend to work in mega games, they don't want everyone peacefully coexisting and working together because it makes it harder to achieve whatever their goals are. So in this case, we had a couple of agents that were from Earth and were trying to kind of keep Mars a little bit destabilized so that they'd be receptive to reuniting with Earth and reestablishing Mars as kind of an Earth outpost. And then there was also a religion that wanted to keep Mars red. So they wanted to make sure that we didn't terraform too much, didn't really have kind of one big goal of technologically progressing to the point that Mars lost what had made it Mars in their eyes. And so they started to intervene as well. So the kind of police faction was investigating a historical incident, and one of the traitors tried to implicate one of the other factions in it in a way that kind of helped drive tensions between some of those factions, as it was hypothesized and discovered that one of the factions might have been responsible for kind of the act of domestic terrorism, 100 years ago.
Yeah, and the game was happening on Discord with a kind of interface that the players could interact with, right?
Yeah, so there were kind of two additional elements to it. The first was that every team had a spreadsheet in Google Sheets, that was kind of automatically hooked into the central control spreadsheets. So a lot of the processing was kind of a combination of automatic and manual as values were pulled in from different sheets about things that had happened. And then the other piece was in Roll20. So that's the map. Roll20 is kind of an online role-playing platform, but we decided for Red Planet Rising this time to try putting the map in there and just seeing what would happen. So there were three kind of separate games that each had a piece of the map. And so the map controls would be hanging out in there, handing out the cards in Roll20 that people got for exploring the different sectors. And so I guess it was kind of a combination of Discord and those two platforms, depending on what your role was. So the political representative probably didn't need to look at either. And the map person spent most of their time in Roll20, and then the resource person spent most of their time in the spreadsheet.
Props to Dan as well, who I believe did most of the work in setting up the Roll20 interface. I know in the first run of the game, we used Google Sheets for the map, and while it went far better than I had expected, I think the conclusion was that Dan's Roll20 interface was a definite improvement on what had originally been put together, which is good to hear.
Definitely. And I think the thing that I personally thought worked the best out of that was that with some of the other systems, anyone could go look at the map. But with Roll20, really only the map players were given access. And so I think it kind of heightened the level to which the map players needed to communicate and interact with the rest of their team. So in some of the previous mega games that I've played, the map person has kind of just been off there doing their own thing. And, you know, if I had questions, at least from the player side, if I had questions, I could just pop into the map and look at it myself. But with only the map players being able to access the map, I think it really helped bring together some of the teamwork and communication and keep them kind of anchored and rooted in the rest of the game.
Yeah, interesting. Was that the same case with the sort of economics side? So the person who was in charge of the economics, they were the only person who had access to the sort of economics sheets, or was that different?
No, the entire team could go in and look at it. And I think that made sense to me because there were a couple of other things in the spreadsheet. So like your target government, the government you are part of, your stability. It wasn't just resources. It was mostly resources, but there were a couple of other things going on in the sheet that everybody kind of needed to look at for the most part every once in a while.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I believe there was like a Discord channel that only the trade players could go into. But yeah, it's an interesting point because there might be something from a design perspective to be said for having that same sort of division of visibility to try and enforce teamwork and reduce like quarterbacking from the team lead and so forth. But yeah, it was more of a happy accident than a conscious design decision.
I think that Dan very intentionally didn't want the rest of the players in, but that might have been just logistically because having, you know, 50 people sitting in Roll20 is definitely going to make things harder on the map controls trying to process things.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, similarly in in-person games, you often find you sort of saying, actually, if you're not a map player, please don't just crowd around the map, which in-person games, again, it very much just is a pragmatic necessity to give the map control space to think the map players the ability to do their jobs. Whereas online, yeah, you have an active decision that you can make about, do I want which parts of the game should be visible to whom and which parts of the game should be hidden from whom, in a way that I think we haven't yet thought much from a design perspective about how you take advantage of that. But yeah, there's a lot of potential options. We did something not dissimilar in Johan's run of Watch the Skies, where people's agent actions at the map were simply communicated via Discord. So unlike the in-person game, people just don't know who else is doing agent actions and where, which, again, something that is dead easy to do online, really hard to do in person. And a good example of where you can definitely make online games or the online format do some heavy lifting for you and kind of use yeah, use it to make the game more interesting.
Yeah.
I would have to imagine that being a traitor in person is a lot harder than it is online, because you can't be constantly going up to the various controls or potentially liaising with, you know, other people behind the scenes that might also be traitors without drawing a fair amount of suspicion, you know, because if, at least for me personally, if I was playing in a mega game and I saw someone that I wouldn't have expected to be constantly asking plot control questions doing so, I would definitely suspect them for kind of reasons that are outside of the bounds of what you want to be happening in a mega game.
Yeah, for sure. And it is a genuine logistical challenge in, for example, in-person Den of Wolves. Although, hopefully, enough players are doing enough crazy shenanigans that the person, ironically, people end up casting false suspicion on themselves because they aren't working as hard to hide their interactions with control, and so they look more suspicious. But yeah, it's one of those things. Certainly for sort of hidden traitor games and hidden role games, I think there is something to be said for online games actually being just a better format for some of those mechanics and having some real potential there.
I really liked something that Johan did for the Watch the Skies, where the alien teams were set up in different Discords so that it wasn't sort of immediately visible, for example, that in that case, for example, there were two alien teams and they weren't immediately in the Discord. Sorry.
Yeah. I agree. That was that was a really effective use of it again, yeah, and it was a nice reveal, because then when people started to suspect there were two alien teams, it was much less obvious. There were no meta textual clues for players to pick up on.
I thought that was really nice,
which maybe something we could use for Den of Wolves as well, or who knows.
Yeah, potentially, I guess, with Den of Wolves, because the game is a bit more. Anyway, we're getting off topic.
Yes.
I was going to ask, so your roles were both a little bit more on the political and narrative side. And, you know, you're both having different plot elements come to you and different narrative things going on. How were you communicating as a control team on sort of staying on top of all the different threads and different things going on?
Okay, so yeah, within the control team, we had a Discord text channel set up. So that's just a sort of like a message board where you can all talk to each other, typing in messages, and they appear. We had several different text threads so that you could try and keep discussion on each topic to just one thread. Obviously, that never quite works out as neatly as it's intended, but we did a reasonable job, I think, of keeping messages in each given thread to just that topic. And yeah, that was the main way, I think, just having that text channel and having text-based conversations there.
And then since this was my first time as control, I of course had tons of questions for Dan and Ed, and luckily enough, I think every time that I needed to talk to one and just make sure that everything that I was going to tell people made sense and flowed cohesively with what they knew of the plot, at least one of them was available in a chat to go and talk to as well. Because during team time, the control always got back together, but a lot of the times, you know, like resource control would be busy processing end of turn stuff, as would the map control. The other three of us were kind of didn't have as much to do to process turns necessarily. So during that time, we would be able to get back together, say, you know, here's an overview of the things that happened that you guys might need to be aware of and think about the implications of, and then kind of discuss and ask questions and, I don't know, make sure that none of us were telling people different things about the same stuff.
Yeah,
I'm a big fan of the concept of a sort of control huddle that meets during team time to sort of kind of go, okay, you know, just make sure to get on the same page. And it's actually something that I've not really seen much until recently, but it just makes so much sense to me. But I think in a lot of games before, that there'd always been the sense of, we don't have time to talk to each other during team time, there's too much going on. But actually, there's a real benefit from taking that time to just all try and organize to meet up and just catch each other up.
Yeah.
And during the busy, the two or three super busy rounds, that was basically just like me listening to them chat while I typed out responses that I had missed. I think at one point I looked and had like, I don't know, 20 something pings that I was having to go through very quickly during that time. But yeah, definitely being able to circle around as a group during that planned time was very helpful. Yeah.
And I think the nature of, well, really, whether online or offline, but I think particularly online games, is that one person needs that sort of executive power over the plot. So having that plot control role and having them just say, look, no, this is the way things are. And if anyone needs to know, if anyone needs to ask within the control team, hold on, can someone just clarify for me what's going on here or here or here? That can, again, be the perfect time to do it. It's an interesting one because in offline games that just tends to be a role filled by game control, but in online games I think we found that there's enough for game control to do just keeping the game together that you need someone full-time just focused on plot.
And one of the things that I really liked that that Johan did for Watch the Skies was that they actually had like four or five plot controls that were each dedicated to kind of a specific chunk of it. Ed was one of them, so I'm sure that he can talk about that more than I encountered as a player. But I thought that was a really clever way to kind of break things up, and you know, as each country had kind of their own plot control to go to out of the larger team.
Yeah, I was certainly nervous about it before the game started. You know, how on earth would we keep track of, like, keep in contact? But again, we mostly just hung out in the same voice channel. And although in some senses we felt quite segregated from the game, like, actually we ended up building a really coherent narrative and building a really interesting narrative because we could be in constant communication with each other. And yeah, to an extent, I think online mega games do feel like they take a bit more guesswork and a bit more like almost just trusting that the players are having a good time because you're doing interesting stuff and because you're helping make their plot interesting, and you rely on the game control to be monitoring the health of that game in that sense, and monitoring for people who are disengaged, and you just concentrate on making sure the interesting things are happening.
Yeah, when you talked about in online games the sort of plot control side and the game control side seems to have, there's sort of been a trend towards splitting that up. Do you think that is the tech element, that the tech element in online games ends up needing more attention and that often ends up going to game control, or is it that you sort of need two separate people on sort of engagement and plot, need two different people? What do you think is kind of behind that?
Yeah, I'm still not quite sure, to be honest. It has just sort of fallen out that way. And I may even be slightly guilty of it in the sense that the first couple of online games... Well, again, I think Johan very much set a trend here, because the first couple of online games of Den of Wolves, as he tends to, very graciously delegated sort of full control over the plot to plot control, and was happy to sort of take a step back and just handle well-being and engagement issues. I think partly anticipating that well-being engagement would be a real issue, which even in that first game, I think people in general played well and safely and kindly with each other. And so that sort of set a trend. But it's certainly a structure that works. If anything, I think that there may well be something for in-person mega games to learn about drawing that delineation between sort of well-being administration versus plot management.
I didn't even realize that they were separate until this conversation. So all of my mega games have been online, and every single one of them has had both a game control and a plot control, with the exception of kind of some of the sports ones that don't really have like a plot necessarily, so don't need a plot control. But all of the ones that I've played in that had some kind of like narrative plot have all had a plot control. And I think that system makes a lot of sense and has worked really well from my perspective.
Yeah. So I think the other distinction maybe is that for in-person mega games historically often just ran once. And so other than the game designer, no one else really knows the game mechanics as a whole and can make those informed decisions about this event narratively looks like this set of sort of facts and figures and numbers mechanically. I mean, I know for my game that I ran ages back now that I was the only person in the room who had that high level view of how the game's different systems interacted and interlocked until I'd like to think a chunk of the way into the day people started to work it out and get the hang of it. In online games, obviously, the games that have run have mostly been Den of Wolves, which many people know very well already. Red Planet Rising, I sat down with Andrew sort of for a solid, I forget how long, sort of 3-4 hours before the very first run to make sure I absolutely understood the rules. And of course, second time round, LJ had played the game and had a good solid understanding of the rules and the narrative. And Running Hot, my understanding is that the first time it ran, again, Paddy was both plot and game control effectively. So there's plenty more examples of online games that aren't springing to my mind, but I think it's notable that plot control spans that boundary between pure narrative and pure mechanics. You have to have a reasonably solid understanding of the mechanics so that you know that when someone says, oh, I want to do this, and you say, okay, that'll take 7 oxygen, that you haven't either given them a price that's so low it's basically free or so high it's basically unachievable, but it represents sort of an appropriate amount of effort for the reward, and that when you give them a narrative reward at the end of whatever shenanigans they've been doing, that again the narrative reward is scaled so that it feels meaningful but isn't game breaking. So there is that sense in which, even as much like in a game of Dungeons and Dragons, when you're the GM picking the monsters to fight in an encounter, you have to pick monsters of an appropriate difficulty level. So GM is as much a mechanical role as it is a narrative role. I would say the same in mega games. And all of that ramble is just to say that's why I think historically the plot control, plot management stuff has tended to sit with the game designer, who is the only person in a position to do it. But actually, I think having it segregated out has been really valuable. And I think where possible, there's something to be said for doing it that way in in-person games as well.
Especially because it makes running a game more accessible to people that consider themselves more mechanical than kind of narrative and wouldn't necessarily be interested or comfortable taking that plot control role, even if they were the one that designed the game.
Yeah, it strikes me as well that, you know, one of the things you were saying earlier about with an online format, as players, you can be asking a lot more questions before the day itself through Discord and, you know, get to know the systems. The same thing applies as well to control. So it's a lot easier running through or demoing a system that runs online than it is, you know, if you've got control coming from, you know, a couple of hours away, to actually get them all together and run through the mechanics in person. So in an in-person game, often it is the case that to some extent, even the control is a little bit figuring out the game as you go along. They've obviously got a little bit more insight and I, you know, some of the, you know, one of the things that you can try to do very much is do some run-throughs with control, but that's not always possible. Whereas it's a lot easier in an online setting. So in that sense, you can start off games where the control do just know the systems a lot better because they've just been involved earlier on in the tech side or the writing side because of the format.
Oh, sure. We had probably already done somewhere between 7 and 10 hours of control meetings kind of before the game even started for Red Planet Rising. And I know personally, I've already started working through some of the stuff for a game that I'm going to be helping out with in March. So, you know, you can definitely start preparing more and really get into the nitty gritty of the game without having to wait until the day of.
Yeah, and just the ability to do things like have that Roll20 interface just sort of open and loaded so that anyone can just connect and start playing around with it, seeing what works, double checking for themselves whether bugs exist, and sort of doing that in free time. There are real big advantages to it for those of us who don't have a great deal of spare time in our lives. Or yeah, as you say, like it sort of eliminates the distance problem and the fact that there's only one physical copy of the game elements. Suddenly they're electronic. There's no sort of restriction on how many people can be messing with them at once.
Yeah. LJ, so this was your first time as control for a game. How did you find the experience?
Oh man. I really enjoyed it. It was somehow both like more rewarding and harder than I was expecting it to be, honestly. but I also found it more kind of draining than being a player. So like I had an amazing time the entire game. And then when we got to the end, I was like, oh my God, I need a nap now. Whereas when I get to the end of like a mega game as a player, like I'm so jazzed up and keyed up and running high on the adrenaline. And so, you know, it was both really great experiences, but definitely different in ways that I wasn't really expecting.
Yeah, interesting. No, they're definitely, they're definitely very, very sort of different experience. Ed, you've done a lot of controlling, particularly with online games. What is the thing for you that keeps you kind of coming back to that role?
Oh, wow. I mean, it's partly my nature, like the experience of making a fun experience for other people, of having created something and seeing other people enjoy it, is really fulfilling, really rewarding. And like mega games are definitely a medium, for want of a better word, where I found I can do that. I enjoy story, and there's something very, very exciting about sort of, you know, you don't as plot control, or indeed as any control for a mega game, tend to create the story. You're just enabling it, but you're sort of often at the hub, sort of pulling all the threads, helping the story to really grow and thrive, and helping the most potentially exciting bits of the game to really reach their full potential. And that is awesome. Yeah, I like the social interaction. I like the creativity that everyone brings to a mega game. I like that it always feels like a big event. I like that it never goes where you expect it to. I like really big, complex systems. I could go on talking all day, but I'm sort of trying not to ramble, not succeeding particularly well. But
I think the thing that I really like, both as a player and as control, is just like helping create this really great story that everybody that wants to during the game can be a part of. And you know, as a player, you get like a single fun story arc that you get to be directly involved in. And then as on the control side, you get to see what literally everybody wants to be doing, and then figure out like how to make them intersect and work together, so that, you know, a group that spends the entire game building up to do this really cool thing can make it work. But at the same time, if it would negatively impact another group, making sure that they have the chance to kind of see it coming and mitigate it and react to it. You know, it's kind of combining the story element with kind of this really big complex puzzle that you have to make sure works out for everybody.
I do love as well, sort of, if I can get a bit airy fairy, what I feel like mega games teach me, or getting to see so many different people's approaches to problem solving, getting to see so many different types of interactions happening. You know, a game like Den of Wolves, which is, you know, is an example that's brought up frequently, where you feel like, you know, you've almost seen every possible solution, every possible permutation, and then lo and behold, someone completely surprises you and does something completely off the wall that you'd never have thought of. And yeah, suddenly it's new and interesting again. It's fascinating to be seeing what approaches people will bring to games, how they'll try and solve them, etc.
Yeah,
and just, I guess, understanding how people do approach different problems.
Mm.
And I think you just, It's one of those things. I mean, I'm quite a fan of human history, human behavior, whatever. What I one of the things I both sort of love and occasionally despair at in mega games is the way that you give people a problem that, you know, humanity's come across so many times in history, and you think, oh well, you know, these are fairly intelligent, like strategic diplomatic people. Oh no, they just messed this problem up. If anything, worse than real human governments do when faced with the same situation. And you start to understand why all these solutions that seem so simple and obvious with the benefit of hindsight and perspective are actually really not trivial. When you're in the moment, your neck's on the line, people are shouting at you. You know, you get to understand why high stakes decision making is difficult and why people often do it badly. And I find that sort of human drama just fascinating to watch as well as engage in.
Mm. Speaking of unexpected behaviors, were there any particularly memorable moments from the game for you?
Oh, wow, where to begin? I mean, the big unexpected narrative arc, one of the players who I don't know that he knew initially he was going to be one of the traitor roles, but had obviously, he was on one of the teams that is sort of slightly more aggressive or slightly more at odds with some of the others anyway. They're a team in Red Planet Rising called Hephaestus, and they're sort of the closest thing Red Mars has to a workers' union. They're sort of inherently somewhat opposed to the faction that wants to form a centralized government and be put back in charge, because in their view, they're not going to give rights to workers. So they started the game with this sort of idea of, well, can we dig a tunnel? And we sort of talked it back and forth and were like, well, yeah, you can dig a tunnel. And then gradually over the course of the game, this turned into, can we dig a tunnel, all the way to the faction whose gimmick is basically that they're what's left of the Martian railway network, and then can we build the biggest bomb ever, and can we continue to dig the tunnel under several unfriendly factions and all the way to the central government building, and you can see where it went from there.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there were several obstacles, you know, we put plenty of obstacles in their way and made sure that it was a difficult thing to achieve that took their whole game and that raised suspicions from several other teams, but they ultimately succeeded, spoiler alert, which was a lot of fun to see happen. And obviously, I think for them, very rewarding, obviously. But I think, like, for the other teams as well, like, there was a genuine sense of, okay, you know, no, you gave us the warnings, you gave us the chances to stop it, you gave us, like, various intel that this sort of thing was going on, and we either spent too much time fighting amongst ourselves or didn't entirely get our act together, and this has happened. So, fair enough.
Yeah, I think... Right. Coupled with that, kind of in parallel but separate, the news team had decided to kind of relaunch their satellites up into the atmosphere. So get it kind of off the planet. They were the only ones that could kind of broadcast to the entire planet and communicate with everybody that way. So because this game didn't have like a dedicated press, instead, one of the factions themselves were the news, and so were the only like their goals weren't necessarily around kind of being press or filling in for press, but they had the ability to kind of do a broadcast via Discord that none of the other factions were able to, because one of their kind of faction technological hangover pieces was that they had the ability to broadcast out to everybody. And they decided that they wanted to launch it up into space so that they could potentially communicate with an incoming ship or Earth, or even just make sure that, you know, they could disseminate more reliable broadcasts and more frequent ones to everybody. And when the head of their faction was arrested by the police, they decided to just crash the satellite back to Earth or back to Mars and send it right into the police headquarters, kind of in retribution for kidnapping and arresting their leader. And so, you know, it was really interesting, at least to me, to see kind of both of those events happen fairly close together. So both of which kind of had been building up for a large part of the game. And so, you know, the tunnels underneath one of the factions blew up, and, you know, people were dealing with the fallout from that. And then I popped back into the map channel and was like, hey guys, guess what? I'm back. just in time for a satellite to come crashing into the police station.
It's a fairly common piece of wisdom in mega games that you don't get on the wrong side of the press, but I've never seen it lived out quite so viscerally, as it were. but it was a real treat. And it's, again, it's one of those things of, you know, was it a sensible or proportionate response? Well, absolutely not. But people in sort of crisis situations don't always make sensible and proportionate responses. And you have to be prepared for that, which was, yeah, crazy. I think, you know, as an arc to the day, it was very different from the first run of the game, which honestly is another really big point in favor of it as a game design. We had a sort of much stronger early move towards unification. We had sort of the central government really take control of the planet in a big way, but then obviously, as we've discussed, discover that being in charge of a group of people that hate each other isn't always what everything it's cracked up to be, and sort of gradually more descend into political infighting as opposed to the first game where there was a lot of actual military combat. And then what we also saw was actually the Earth government agents, rather than going for a sort of sabotage approach, sort of ended up pushing for a slightly more sort of straightforward, like, well, wouldn't you all like to actually come back into the fold, as it were? And I think quite a number of the government, quite a number of the factions by the end of the day had sort of reconciled themselves to the fact that, okay, being a free independent Mars might just be a bit more effort than it's worth. Why don't we just let EarthGov be in charge of us? Which, again, was very interesting to see as control, because EarthGov are sort of meant to be an antagonist in the game. They're not wholly evil by any means, but they are obsessed with control, obsessed with being in charge, and ultimately want to take authority and self-determination away from the Martian teams if they can, purely as a self-defensive move. And it was fascinating to see how, without, I think, control really shoving people down that route, a lot of people just went, yeah, we can live with that. Actually, that sounds a lot easier than this vicious political infighting that we've been doing up to this point. Why not make someone else in charge and make it all their problem to sort out all of these arguments and differences? It's nice to have someone to blame who's off planet, as it were.
They were also completely different. Kind of the overarching kind of narrative story of the events were also very different from the first run to the second run. So I might be biased because I was directly involved with this arc, but kind of one of the big story arcs from the first one was getting one of the ships back into space. That was basically like, it was the USSN Enterprise and was pretty much the most powerful ship in the galaxy. So even more powerful than anything, any individual ship that Earth might have had. And so there were a number of factions that all came together and worked to kind of get that back into the sky, including kind of the other military superpower ship that had also been grounded, having to give up like essential components so that they would basically not be able to get off the ground themselves. And you know, just a lot of factions working together to make that happen from a kind of technological, scientific front. But I think that this run was, to completely agree with Ed, much more about kind of political maneuvering and posturing. And so a lot of the plot elements that people wanted to work towards were more like specific things to help out just their faction, or ways to kind of combat or mitigate the other like main governments. Because after there was kind of the one centralized unified government, they're kind of split into two separate factions that were a little bit antagonistic towards each other. And actually, one of the main reasons that both were receptive to rejoining Earth was because they were afraid of the other one. And so a lot more of the plot elements were related to kind of that centralized power struggle towards the second half of the game, as opposed to some of the more like scientific arcs that had been present in the first one, because there had been a couple of others as well. So that was definitely interesting to see from my side as well, because you know, obviously having this being my first time as plot control and having played in the previous run, we had thoroughly prepared for, you know, here's how to make it different if people decide to do similar things to what happened in the first one. Like, here's how we make sure that it's not just the same thing again. So we had, you know, hurdles that they had to overcome that were completely different from the first time. But then, you know, those were paths that people didn't even end up choosing to go down at all. So that was really interesting to see for me from the control side.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think there's something to be said for, obviously, like, a lot of this comes down to game design. Like, you obviously, if you're able as control to take the players' ideas and make them do interesting things, that helps. But ultimately, noticeably in Red Planet Rising, each of the factions has a sort of interesting and complex backstory. Each of the factions has an interesting and complex motivation. And the map is littered with things that look like MacGuffins. So you're not short of things that look like, if you go and investigate them, they'll do something interesting, and that there's different ways of trying to develop them. So, yeah, you know, there's a lot of possibility space for the players to get into. And I think, yeah, the fact that in two runs, sort of, there's been only really a fractional overlap in what players have explored. And as LJ says, like, there's nothing obliging control from run to run to keep the things that can be explored exactly identical anyway. It's a game with a lot of legs.
It also helps that the sets of objectives that the teams have are variable and open-ended. So, you know, you don't have just a single, like, you're trying to make this one thing happen. I really like that the way that they have been set up to have, most seem to have, like, some kind of government, loose government objective, some kind of map/resource objective, and then a couple of kind of narrative objectives. And being able to pursue kind of as many of those as you want at the same time, and the fact that they're so open-ended means that they can be interpreted in entirely different ways from play to play. And it, you know, you don't have people going down the same, this is what I need to do track.
Yeah, no, I think that's
I love Den of Wolves. I've played it 3 times now, and it's probably still my favorite mega game, but I think that it does tend to feel like it does have a similar story arc most of the plays that I've played, at least. And that's not a bad thing, to be clear, because, you know, if it's a really good story, you definitely want to play it over and over again. But the thing that I really like about Red Planet Rising is that there's so many different ways that the story could go just based off of player choices and objectives and backstory and everything that goes into it.
It sounds like it's got a slightly more sandbox feel.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
Mm. Yeah. Would either of you have any pieces of advice for anyone that's thinking of maybe trying out Control, maybe for their first time or stepping into a more narrative-focused Control role? I know it's a very big topic, you know, how to be Control, but any kind of pieces that jump out?
Just start by telling someone that's kind of what you want to work towards. So even before I played in, or maybe it might have been right after I played in my very first mega game, which was the Den of Wolves that was run by Kurt back in, I think it was May of last year. Afterwards, I reached out to him and among other things, basically said, yeah, someday I would really like to be plot control for a game. And so I think that kind of set the ball rolling, and it's unlikely from what I've seen that necessarily someone's going to reach out and ask and say, hey, like, do you want to work towards jumping into plot control, or do you want to jump into control at all? It might be something that you have to just ask about.
I'd add, and I can't think of a better way to phrase this than don't be scared of it, although maybe that's not the most encouraging way of putting it, but I think it can be daunting. And obviously there's sort of a variety of, so firstly, there is a variety of different control roles, and one will be right for you. Like, there's everything from, like, you're very narrative heavy, sort of roles like plot control and sort of in Denethor's council control and ones like that, that you know, a lot of it is sort of thinking on your feet, having some understanding of the game's mechanics, but primarily just what was I going to say? Sorry, I completely lost my train of thought.
No worries.
Having some understanding of the game's mechanics, but primarily like helping to craft an interesting narrative, helping to get the players, make the players' actions mean something. Whereas there's also a lot of roles that are much more mechanically focused. Often you'll find the map control role in games is about this, where it's just, here's a set of rules. They're actually not that complicated, but you are required to learn them precisely and make sure they're applied very clearly and efficiently, especially make sure that the game sort of rolls along and doesn't get hung up, and have a little bit of that sort of slightly, yeah, just sort of teacher-like attitude of, okay, I recognise that there was a bit of uncertainty there, but the game has to keep moving, so we're going to get back to that and keep moving. Yeah, like ultimately, players will try to help you. Players in mega games are there to have fun. They're there to build an interesting story. You'll occasionally have to disappoint them, but by and large, like, they're very cooperative, they're very friendly, and they want to do something interesting as well. And as control, you're there to help them out. I don't know, like, it's fun.
It is.
Being control is a whole lot of fun. It's not for everyone. I know some people really find that it feels too removed from the game, and that's fair enough, but I'd say for almost anyone, give it a try once you've been to a couple of mega games. And if you're the sort of person who enjoys running a role-playing game, being a GM or whatever, then it's very, very likely that you'll eat this up as well. There are definitely differences, and there's probably a whole podcast's worth of conversation on like what are those subtle differences between running a mega game where everyone in the room has to have a meaningful story, where as opposed to running a role-playing game where just this small group of people have a meaningful story. But ultimately, if you enjoy helping people create an exciting story through the power of their imagination and a fairly chunky book of rules, then this is just that. And it's, I would say, unless you want to actually design a mega game, in which case that's quite a challenge, but if you just want to help control someone else's game, if anything, I would say it requires less prep, less narrative creativity than GMing a tabletop role-playing game. Slightly different kind of mindset, but once you've been to a couple of mega games, you'll have a fairly clear idea of where those differences lie, what a mega game looks like when it's being done right, and sort of how to make it exciting.
And to add on to that, I would highly recommend serving as control on a mega game before fully designing a mega game yourself, just because getting the perspective of what it's like to be behind the computer, making sure that things flow and work well for players, will really help you with designing the game and the system that you're putting together.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, for yeah. sure.
And I really echo, you know, something you were saying earlier, LJ, about, you know, the reward that you get from controlling is very different to the reward that you get from playing. And I completely agree with that. I get, you know, a very, very different buzz from controlling to playing, and it's so, so satisfying, you know, when a game has gone well, to have kind of been part of the team making that happen for people.
The other thing I'd say maybe as advice to, well, any control, and particularly people who are new to control, is understand the intent of the game and understand the game designer's intent. So to the best of your ability, if you're focusing on one specific mechanical area, sort of understand at least at a high level how that locks into other areas of the game. Like, oh, you know, even if it's something as simple as I'm running the resource generation part of the game, okay, well, if the game designer is available, ask them. If not, ask game control, who hopefully will know, you know, how much should this area of the game be kicking out? Like, how much time should people be spending engaging with it? Like, where are people going to find their fun in this game? What problems do you want people to be engaging with and solving? And sort of what meta-narrative conflicts do you want people to be engaged in? And that really helps, because often the game designer will put a ton of work into making sure the game is able to deliver a certain experience. And if you take the game, so Watch the Skies is a good example, where a lot of people look at it and think this is a game primarily about humans in conflict with aliens, and the original design intent from Jim was very much, this is a game about humans being in conflict with other humans, sort of triggered by the arrival of aliens. And once you realize that, you sort of, even that one line of like, oh, that's what he was going for, suddenly a whole load of the game makes a whole load more sense, and you're able to run the game so much better because of it. And so, yeah, I think to the great extent you can understand, and obviously this goes back on game designers and game control to say, listen, if you're going to have people come and control your game, make sure you've briefed them thoroughly, not just on the nitty-gritty of the mechanics, but also on that high-level intent, where you expect the players to have difficult decisions to make, where you expect them to fall out with each other, all that sort of thing. Because then control don't have to focus on like creating content where there doesn't need to be any, and can sort of instead just direct players' attentions towards the kind of conflict that the game is designed to promote and to emphasize, as it were.
And I think adding on to what Ed said earlier, it's much less intimidating having done Control once now, thinking about doing Control again. So realistically, if you're worried about messing things up for people, you probably can't. Just with the way that kind of the game works and hopefully the amount of kind of prep that's gone into it. And like, personally, I've never gotten like mad at a member of control as a player. And so if you're worried about people getting like mad at you for stuff, like that's not going to happen. Just think like, would you get mad at a control person that accidentally told you the wrong thing or didn't give you the answer that you wanted, even though, you know, they gave you the right answer? You know, I think it's kind of, for some, it might be scarier to say, it might just be a very scary prospect to be responsible for so much of other people's enjoyment and experience. But realistically, you can't mess it up as long as you try. I don't know. I'm rambling. Sorry.
No, I think that's right. Players are ultimately responsible for the quality of their own experience to a degree. And yeah, as control, not only can you not take responsibility for the quality of players' experience, but past a certain point, you shouldn't try. Again, I'd use the analogy of a tabletop role-playing game. That one person who's sat there on their phone reading the news, not listening to anything anyone else is saying, is not going to have a fun time, and it's not the DM's fault. Maybe, you know, maybe it is to an extent if the story is really boring, but there's a certain kind of player who will not get much out of the game because they are not going to put the effort in to engage. And the same is true of mega games. Like, players will bring their own story, bring their own objectives, bring their own imagination. A player who sort of turns up to a mega game and just expects control to sort of dance for their entertainment all day isn't going to have a great time, but that wasn't control's fault. Control should be about giving players, rewarding players' imagination, helping direct players back towards the sort of key conflicts of the game and the key objectives of their faction, but then, and giving them the tools to pursue those. But you're not responsible for sort of spoon feeding and babysitting people towards those objectives. And I mean, there's a whole other piece about player well-being, and when a player genuinely just doesn't get it, how can you help their day be at least not terrible? But players, like, a mega game is something that players will have to have brought something to and put something into in order to get something out of, and you as control can't and shouldn't be making up that difference.
Yeah.
And just the sheer number of times that I missed people asking me questions or like forgot to circle back around. You know, everybody's very understanding about that kind of thing. I was definitely worried that, because, you know, because I had at any given point in time, like 10 to 15 threads that I needed to respond to or loop back on, you know, when it did take a little while, or if I told somebody something wrong and then had to go back and correct it, you know, everybody was very understanding and just kind of excited to be there and be a part of the game. So, you know, you're really just enabling other people's fun. And so if that sounds like fun, then definitely try and be control. And if you'd rather not, then, you know, that's okay too.
Yeah. Well, it's been really fantastic hearing about the game. And, you know, I feel like we've covered lots of ground here on, you know, kind of online games. You know, we've got a bonus touch on a couple different mega games as well. So that's been really nice. So yeah, thank you so much to you both for being on the podcast. Have you got any other games lined up?
Out of everything that's been kind of officially announced, I'm just playing. So I'm excited to play with you guys in the future.
Nice.
No, same. I will mention, well, I mean, given that MegaCon is in a couple of weeks, fingers crossed, if all goes well, I will be helping to run Shot Heard Around the Universe at it, which is a game by the inimitable Tim Campbell, loosely based on a set of historical events, but about a bunch of colonies in space grappling with the question of whether independence from a space empire is worth fighting for, and whether it has benefits to outweigh the disadvantages. And yeah, I imagine by the time this broadcasts that will be fully booked, but I'm very much looking forward to trying to make that a reality in the online space.
Similarly, I think I will be helping with Den of Wolves, where we'll hopefully be trying out some new technical stuff and ways to potentially kind of iterate even further on the concept of the online mega game. So fingers crossed.
Brilliant. Well, thank you. Thank you both so much for being on the podcast. And yeah, I hope this is, you know, maybe encouraged a few of you listening to try out being controlled.
Do it. It's worth it.
Awesome. Thank you, Matt. Thanks for having us.
Yep.
Our thanks to LJ and Ed for joining Matthew for that lovely little chat. We hope you found it interesting. As Ed mentioned, depending on when you're listening to this, there may be a chance for you to attend MegaCon, which is happening from the 19th to 21st of March in 2021. There will be seminars, playtests, social games, and, what do you know, mega games, including Red Planet Rising. Head over to megacon.org.uk for a full schedule, or, if you're lazy, and I respect that, take a look at the show notes for a nice and easy direct link. If you've missed it, please don't be sad, as there should be lots of content on the website to catch up with whatever you may have missed. Thank you once again for listening. If you're new here, please do head over to our website, megagameassembly.com, where you'll find a schedule of all upcoming games, blogs, other episodes of this very podcast, and lots of other megagame resources, including entire free megagames that you can download and dissect for your own pleasure. No judgment from me, whatever gets you through the day. So until next time, thank you and goodbye.